From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Is London ready to light the torch? Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Security and overcrowding are major concerns, but the biggest threat to this year's Olympic Games is the weather in London. As the torch was being carried through the city today, a growing sense of excitement was being reported, with opening ceremonies scheduled for Friday. Which athletes and which teams will be getting the most attention? Is the U.S. or China likely to win the most medals? What about those runners from Kenya? We'll get previews and look at how much the Olympic Games really mean to different countries around the world. On Reporter's Notebook later on, gun violence and the presidential campaign. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warman Alney, back with To the Point. The U.S. women's team has won its first soccer game, but the official opening of the London Olympic Games won't be until Friday. We'll hear about the sense of anticipation in the city, the importance of the games in different countries, and which individuals and events are most likely to gain the world's attention. On Reporter's Notebook, since the massacre in Aurora, Colorado, there have been calls for the president and his Republican challenger to address the issue of gun violence. We'll hear how they've responded. First, this news update. China's most dramatic political upheaval in decades continued today with murder charges against the wife of Bo Xilai. He was deposed in March as the party boss of Chongqing. His wife, Gu Qilai, is accused, along with an aide, of murdering British businessman Neil Haywood. Adam Minter is a correspondent based in Shanghai, where he writes for Bloomberg Worldview, among other outlets. He appears often on our program. And Adam Minter, we're glad to have you back.
Well, glad to be here.
Tell us what is so important about Neil Haywood and his murder in terms of the leadership transition that's about to take place this fall.
Well, it's a complicated web. Neil Haywood was an English businessman who had become very close to the Bo family, of which Bo Xilai is the head of. And Bo's family is one of these families in China you could almost call royal family. He's one of the descendants of the Immortal Eight people who really helped Chairman Mao, finish the revolution that switched power in China. Bo was very much poised to become a leader at the top of the Politburo come this fall. And he had been fighting very hard for that position. Now, we don't know how people become members of the elite Politburo, but by all accounts, he was there. One of the ways he had done it was he had been very PR-oriented. He had done a big anti-mafia crackdown, had been cracking down on corruption in the city of Chongqing. But in the process, we now know that he was becoming more and more corrupt himself. Meanwhile, Neil Haywood was one of the means by which he was corrupt. We now know that Neil Haywood was helping the Bo family get money out of China, into the UK, into the United States. Something happened in the course of that relationship. We don't know what it is, but we now know today it's official, at least if you're going to believe the state news report, that Gu Qilai, with one of Bo Xilai's manservants, if you will, murdered him by poisoning him. And that murder and the circumstances by which that murder was found out ended up ending Bo Xilai's basically ascent to the top of the Politburo. And now we don't know where he is, but we do know that his wife is about to be prosecuted for murder, and his political ascent, at least for the time being, is over.
The trial, as I understand it, is not taking place in the same place where the murder allegedly occurred.
Well, and that's one of the very strange things. I mean, all we know about this very significant news is what amounts to about a 200-word, for all accounts, press release issued by Xinhua, the state news agency. And it tells us a couple of very interesting things. One, yes, we're going to have this trial in Hefei, which is a very small backwater capital to Anhui province. This is a little bit like, a crime, say, taking place in L.A., and they decide to have the the trial in, say, Biloxi, Mississippi. It doesn't make a lot of sense, and nobody really knows why this is the case. The other thing that's very interesting about what we heard today is that she's referred in the official documents as Bogu Kalai, and that's significant. They've added the character for Bo's name to her name. That's a first. That really hasn't been done before, but clearly they're trying to connect him more closely to this murder. And the third thing that's significant to know is that this is not going to be a trial in any sense of the word. I mean, the release itself in English says of the case, the evidence is irrefutable and substantial, and that the trial will be held on a day to be decided. I mean, it's clear that the decision has been made, what her guilt is, and more likely than not, the penalty has been decided as well. So it's a very, very curious political trial. I mean, any sheen this may have as a judicial proceeding should really be forgotten. I mean, this is about politics, and there's a lot of negotiations going on behind the scenes to figure out how to do this, because Bo Xilai and his wife still have very powerful friends in the Politburo, and say if the death penalty were going to be a part of what happens here, there's certainly going to be horse trading that goes on the political side to make sure that all parties are satisfied, if you will.
We just have a minute left, but as to the political transition, you mentioned that Bo Xilai was part of one of the immortal eight families that helped Mao Zedong. I gather that he's very much a Mao supporter. Does that mean that he's a sort of revisionist, and does this suggest that there's that kind of dynamic going on in the political change?
Well, it's a very complicated question. I mean, on one hand, he had, prior to becoming the party secretary of Chongqing, he was the commerce secretary, and he developed quite the reputation as a pro-commerce, pro-business kind of guy. And yet, once he got to Chongqing, he started this red campaign where he was very much resuscitating, patriotic sing-alongs, patriotic television shows, and it smacked many people in the leadership as sort of backtracking to some of the thoughts and methods and politics of the Cultural Revolution. And many people think...
Adam Minter, sorry to cut you off, but we've run out of time in Shanghai. We're going to talk to you later about the Olympic Games, past and present. In a moment, is London ready to light the torch on To the Point?
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Wormen, I'll be back with To the Point. The official opening of the Olympic Games won't be until Friday, but the world is beginning to focus on London as the torch is being carried through the streets of the city. Celebrities and politicians are turning up, including Mitt Romney, who caused a minor stir with these comments about security preparations.
You know, it's hard to know just how well it will turn out. There are a few things that were disconcerting, the stories about the private security firm not having enough people, the supposed strike of the immigration and customs officials. That obviously is not something which is encouraging.
Mr. Romney backpedaled a bit on that later after meeting with the Prime Minister, David Cameron. He's visiting London as part of his presidential campaign and as the man who saved the 2002 Winter Games in Salt Lake City. Nick Harris is chief sports news correspondent for the English paper The Mail on Sunday. He's also editor of SportingIntelligence.com, which specializes in the business and finance of sport. Nick Harris, good to have you back on our program.
Hi, good to be here.
Did Mr. Romney make much of a splash in London, or has that been pretty much overlooked as the games begin?
Yeah, to be honest, it hasn't made massive headlines here. No, I'm sure it's probably a more important story in America, him being a key American figure. I mean, we're kind of more wrapped up with the ceremony tomorrow night, the opening ceremony, the questions of how bad is the traffic going to get and who is going to light the cauldron. These are kind of the issues that London and Britain is obsessed with, not to mention unseasonably hot weather. And when I say unseasonably hot weather, our summers are not usually very hot. And we've had weeks and weeks of rain, and suddenly it's boiling hot. So these are the kind of things that are obsessing us in London today.
Nobody knows, as I take it, who is going to take the torch finally and light the Olympic flame.
No, we don't know. It's a great question. I mean, even in the last few hours, the bookmakers over here, the odds have come tumbling in on Sir Roger Bannister, the man who, of course, famously ran the first sub-4-minute mile on being the guy who will carry it. But in the last few days, we've had heated speculation that will be one of our rowers, Sir Steve Redgrave, who's won five Olympic gold medals in five games up to and including Sydney. There's also been speculation it would be Daley Thompson, one of our famous decathletes, that David Beckham might be involved in some capacity. That it may be a combination of all of them with a local school child involved. The simple truth is we do not know yet. Nobody has confirmed it. Nobody knows for sure. And I guess we might not know even until tomorrow night when it happens.
David Beckham, I gather, not chosen as one of the senior members of the British football team.
Exactly, and that was a surprise to a lot of people. A lot of people made the assumption that Beckham would be one of the overage members of that 18-man squad for the Great British team, and that caused some controversy when he wasn't picked. The coach, Stuart Pearce, said it, for footballing reasons, Beckham wasn't picked. Of course, Beckham makes his living now in the US with LA Galaxy. He's 37 years old. He's now considered to be a kind of a top rank footballer in terms of he no longer plays for England, for example, but we still expected him to be named in that squad and as captain, not just because of his ongoing football abilities, but also because of the key role he played in bringing the games to London as an ambassador. But he wasn't picked. He's not involved in the team. But obviously he's here in London and he will be involved in some kind of ambassadorial role during the games. And we're pretty certain he'll have a role in the ceremony tomorrow night. But again, we don't know exactly what that role will be yet.
Well, after all the concern about the security, about the traffic, about the weather, here's the torch now beginning to move through the streets of London. Are people beginning to turn to the games and get excited about the athletes themselves and what might actually take place?
Yeah, I mean, the torch relay has been going on for a number of weeks now, 8 to 9 weeks. So it's been...
But not in London.
No. I mean, it's just arrived in London the last couple of days. Yeah. I mean, obviously, it's been slow burn across Britain in the last few weeks. The organisers say that 9 million individuals have turned out to see it, which is a fifth of the British population actually physically seen it as it's gone its way around Britain, which is quite impressive. Now it's in London. To be honest, I think not so much the torch arriving in London, but just the proximity now that the games begin properly tomorrow with the opening ceremony. You know, actually, they started yesterday, day minus two. The British women's football team was in action and won their first match. The British men are in action tonight at Manchester United's home, Old Trafford, just this evening, starting shortly against Senegal. So the games are underway. I guess it's just the actual, you know, the phony war's over. We've been waiting for this for 7 years. It's all about to start. And that, more than anything else, is kind of generating the excitement. And I guess we're all looking forward to seeing what this ceremony is going to be like and how many people are going to, you know, tens of millions of people here in Britain will tune in to watch that. People excited to see what it's like and excited for this real sport to get underway in earnest on Saturday morning.
Should point out that the American women's football team, as you call it, soccer team as we call it, also won its first game. Nick Harris again with the Mail on Sunday and SportingIntelligence.com. Alan Abramson is the founder and columnist of Three Wire Sports. That's a blog about the Olympic movement and international sports. He's also chief columnist for NBCOlympics.com, and he teaches sports writing at the USC Annenberg School of Journalism when he isn't watching athletes. Alan Abramson, very good to have you back on our program 4 years later.
Always a pleasure.
What are we looking for in terms of major developments athletically at this Olympic Games?
Well, I think for an American audience in particular, we're looking for two things, maybe three. Number one would be watching Ryan Lochte and Michael Phelps duke it out. 4 years ago, it was, could Michael Phelps win 8 gold medals, and the answer was, why, yes, he could. And now it's, can Ryan Phelps be the swim king? And I think after watching the two of them give dueling press conferences today, and I'm just saying that for a fact, they were at different press conferences, they are both tanned, fit, and ready, as Hunter Thompson would have said, and it's going to be great to watch them throw it down. They are both ready to swim. That's the first thing.
Ryan Lochte and Michael Phelps, they're going to meet the first day?
They meet the very first day in the 400-meter individual medley. Michael Phelps is the defending Olympic champion in 2004 and 2008. Ryan Lochte won the event at the Olympic trials in Omaha. It should be a great, great race.
Is that a heat or is that a final?
It'll be a final.
Okay. What else?
Number two will be, can the American team win the gold medal count and the overall medal count? Olympic medal count watchers will remember that the Chinese came up big 4 years ago in Beijing. Some people will say, oh, the Russians are going to be tough and the Chinese are going to be tough. Myself, I think the Americans are going to come up very, very strong here. And it's amazing to me, frankly, because in our country, football not what they call football here, but what we call football is king. Football has sucked the life out of every other sport in the United States, with the exception maybe of basketball. Excuse me. And it's amazing that American young people come over here and win medals. If you think about it, the United States Olympic Committee's annual budget is $150 million, and Ohio State's athletic department budget is on the order of $125 or $130 million. And yet Americans expect the Olympic team to come over here and kick some butt. And they do. The swim team's going to win roughly 30 of the 32 medals. The track team's going to come over and win maybe 24, maybe 30 medals. The wrestling team has competitors in 17 of the 18 classes. The fencing team is really, really good. It's amazing, actually. If we ever got serious in the United States, really serious the way they are in other countries, the United States is the only country in the world that does not get federal funding for its Olympic program. If the United States ever got serious about funding its Olympic team, the United States would dominate Olympic sport. I'm convinced of it.
Let me go back to Nick Harris with the Mail on Sunday and sportingintelligence.com. Does it make you sort of grind your teeth to hear that?
No, actually, it's quite an interesting take on it because, you know, I guess from the British perspective of looking at American sport from the outside in and looking at the collegiate system of sport and how every university has got a massive sports department, that sports scholarships are a huge deal, that sports at a tertiary educational level in America is enormous. You know, that's completely different from Britain, and the assumption certainly from our side of the pond on American sport is that American sport is massively highly developed, and your athletes certainly at university level are much better kind of funded and resourced, albeit by their university teams in collegiate sport, than their equivalents are here. I hear what Alan's saying about the federal funding. I mean, we've had kind of state lottery funding of athletes, our Olympic athletes, seriously, only since the build-up to the Sydney Games in 2000, and that made a massive difference after the disaster of 1996, Atlanta for the British team, with just a gold medal. You know, we had to do something about it, and we went to Sydney and won 11, and then Athens 9, and then in Beijing 19 to finish fourth in the medals table, which is, frankly speaking, really going to be the minimum requirement for Team GB this time is that fourth spot, and hopefully even third. I find that kind of it's enlightening. Enlightening view. I had no idea that was the view within the U.S. of an underfunded team, because you know your basketball guys are coming over to win. Alan can probably know the figure, but is it either 14 or 19 gold medals in the history of the Olympics the USA basketball team have won? You know, they're going to win. I mean, these are all guys from the NBA who earn an average of $2.9 million.
You can't say they're underfunded.
No. I mean, the NBA, you know, these guys aren't underfunded, are they? So they're going to win the basketball gold. And you know, Michael Phelps is neither is he underfunded and the top swimmers. You know, they obviously earn millions and millions and millions in endorsements. You know, I simply just don't know the rest of your guys, you know, how your fencing teams are funded. But certainly my assumption is that our athletes would not, you know, are not kind of rolling around in money. The grassroots, you know, we've got a team of 584, the British team here, and the vast majority of those would be having funding from lottery money. But we're talking about to the tune of, you know, 10 to 20,000 pounds a year for everything.
I'll get back to Alan Abramson in a moment, but before I do, I know, Nick Harris, you need to leave. What special events are Brits going to be looking at in these Olympics?
Okay, well, I mean, for a start, internationally, we're excited to see Phelps. I was in Beijing. I had the privilege to watch every single one of Phelps' 8 goals. I was in the press conference today, 39 camera crews, dozens of photographers. We're interested in Phelps and Lochte as well. That's the big jewel in the pool. We're interested in that. We're interested in the other big international name, Usain Bolt. Can he defend his 100 and 200 meter sprint titles and win another 3 golds? So we're interested in that. More parochially, we're interested in our cyclists. Bradley Wiggins has just won the Tour de France. First guy in 99 years, the British guy, to win a Tour de France. We've got a great cycling team in Beijing, so we'll be looking at Bradley Wiggins, Sir Chris Hoy, Victoria Pendleton, our cycling team. Our swim team did well in Beijing by our standard, 6 medals. We're looking at Rebecca Adlington to win another gold and perhaps another gold in the pool in the open water. And our sailors, Ben Ainsley's going for a 4th gold medal and 5th medal overall in the sailing and rowing. Sailing, rowing, cycling, the sitting down sports are the ones that we excel at. So they're the sports we're going to look at. and be excited about. And as I said, Phelps and Bolt are obviously the stardust names of the games for anybody, including us.
Never heard of the sittings, but down sports referred to it quite that way way before. Thank you for that phrase. Still with us is Adam Minter, based in Shanghai for Bloomberg Worldview. Most recently, his latest story is Beijing's Olympic glory washes away. It has to do a lot with the massive rainstorms and flooding and the failures of the sewer system in Beijing. Adam Minter, welcome back to you. What about the funding of athletics in China? It's very different from what we've heard about either the United States or Great Britain.
Yeah, it's a completely different system. In fact, you'd have to say it's probably the polar opposite of the American system. Nobody knows precisely how much money is spent on state athletics in China, but it's considerable. And one way to think about it is that there really is no semi-pro or professional athletics in China that are not connected to the state. So even though you have, for example, a Chinese basketball association, it's not like the NBA in the U.S. where it's an independent entity. It's actually a part of the massive state sports bureaucracy. And the way the state sports bureaucracy works is they go out into schools, when these kids are preschoolers, 4 and 5 years old, measure them, look for body types, look for personality types that they think will function well in certain kinds of sports. And these kids at very young ages, at 5, 6 years old, with their parents' permission, are then inducted into these state sports schools. And I believe there's about 150 of them nationwide. And if you are going to play sports professionally in a Chinese sense, and that is you are paid by the state to learn to play these sports, it has to happen within that system. That system has a lot of great advantages. I mean, these kids are drilled all day long. They do their exercises all day long. And it's one of the reasons why you see Chinese do very well in individual precision sports like shooting, like archery, like gymnastics, like weightlifting, which is not exactly a precision sport, but they do very well there. But the curious thing is you don't have kids coming in. For example, I live very close to a place, Hawaii Park in Shanghai, which is sort of the Coney Island for basketball of Shanghai. That's where the really good kids play basketball. But basketball is something that you don't start excelling at until you're a teenager, really, maybe in adolescence. Those kids who are playing, phenomenal basketball at Shuzhou White Park are never going to have a chance to try out for a college team, a high school team, much less make it into a professional team. They're out. Meanwhile, the kids who are learning to play basketball within the state system, they're never going to be allowed to go down to Shujiawei Park and play basketball. And it's one of the reasons why the Chinese have had a lot of trouble developing in team sports. Again, you'll see them do very well in individual sports and in dual sports like a ping pong where you actually play doubles or badminton.
Okay.
But in the other sports, they won't do so well just because they haven't had the chance to develop. They don't start them in a developmental
okay.
way. They start them quite young.
We'll come back in a moment with Adam Minter and Alam Abramson. We'll be also talking about runners in Kenya. Nick Harris, thank you very much for being with us. We'll be back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Subscribe to the To the Point podcast at kcrw.com or on the podcast page at iTunes. You can also find To the Point on KCRW's smartphone apps, now for iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry.
Warren Olney back with To the Point, talking about the Olympic Games opening on Friday, although some games already have been played. The American women have won their first soccer game. The torch is moving its way through London. Nobody knows exactly who's going to ultimately light the Olympic flame. Nick Harris is gone. Alan Abramson still with us, however, with the Three Wire Sports and NBCOlympics.com. I'm going to give you an opportunity to respond to what Nick Harris said about the funding of athletes. He pointed out that certainly the American pro basketball team is well-funded. They're all millionaires in and of themselves. And he said Mr. Phelps and others get a lot of endorsements. So it's not quite as poor a kind of backing as you might have indicated earlier.
Cleverly enough, he picked the exceptions to the rule. Mr. Phelps is certainly making millions, but most people on the swim team are not. The American basketball team, most of those guys are one-and-dones in college. By the way, the American men's basketball team is going to win one medal. That would be one medal. So that would leave about 95, 96, maybe, 99 more. All those fencers and all those wrestlers and all those other people that I talked about, they have to find a way to become the Olympic athletes that Americans want them to be. I assure you that the people on the modern pentathlon team are not making millions of dollars. I assure you that people on the fencing team are not making millions of dollars. In the United States, we have got to find a new and different, maybe even a radical way to fund the Olympic team, and I've got it. The way to do it is if the likes of T. Boone Pickens can turn Oklahoma State into a college football power, that's the way the Olympic team needs to be funded. People have got to step up and find that there's a new revenue stream that's out there that can be tapped. There's a whole way of funding the team that's just sitting there that has yet to be, again, to use the same word, tapped.
So you need a billionaire that likes fencing.
Yeah, well, or whatever sport it is. You know, people donate to their colleges all the time. People need to start donating to the Olympic team. Nobody's just done it.
Alan Abramson again with Three Wire Sports and the NBCOlympics.com website. We'll be hearing more from you and more from Adam Minter in Beijing as well. Excuse me, in Shanghai. But we also want to talk about another kind of sport or event, I should say, and a different mode of training. Adirondack Finn is with the Guardian newspaper. He's author of a book called Running with the Kenyans, about the extraordinary training that goes on in that country and the amazing success that they've had in the Olympic Games. Good, Mr. Finn, to have you on our program.
Hi, it's good to be here.
You went there. You went to the mountain in Kenya. Tell us what it's like and describe that situation.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting listening to stories of funding in different parts of the world. I mean, in Kenya, the whole concept of funding doesn't really exist. These guys basically live on the hope that they will get selected for races and then they will win. And then it's the winnings that's the only money they get. But the thing is, enough of these guys are successful and do actually achieve that they've sparked this whole culture of running that is just incredible to behold. When you go to there's this one small town up in the Rift Valley in Kenya called Iten, and if you go there early in the morning, there are hundreds and hundreds of runners, sometimes thousands of runners, and these are all guys training to an elite level of competition, and they're running around purely living on hope, to be honest, most of them.
Are they trained by the same individuals?
Well, no. I mean, there's different coaches. A lot of them are self-coached. A lot of them are running completely on their own, just running together in groups, forming their own groups. But there are a couple of top coaches out there who are kind of pick up the best of them and coach them. A lot of Europeans, quite a few Italian coaches out there who've trained, you know, their own national teams, and have realized that they can, that these guys need help out there. They've got an incredible talent, but they don't have the coaches. There are some good Kenyan coaches emerging now as well, but they're all in groups. They're groups of maybe 20, 30 athletes, some with coaches, some just coaching themselves, and just charging around everywhere.
So they do the best that they can to get there. What is it about that town in the Rift Valley that is so conducive to people being able to learn how to run?
Well, partly it's just people are going where everybody else is, because there's people to train with. They've heard that people go there and they end up being successful. They get picked up by managers. They hear there's a lot of groups to train with. So partly it's just a snowballing effect, and it seems to be growing all the time. The people arriving in this town almost weekly from all the outlying villages and even the other side, different parts of Kenya. Another factor is the altitude. It's at 8,000 feet there, so it's a very good altitude for training, for long distance running, and a lot of the people, a lot of the Kenyans, I mean, the altitude is a factor in their success. I mean, they're all born and raised at altitude, so that gives them a kind of natural advantage, and that draws them to the town as well.
Is it good to train at that altitude if you're going to be running in Britain in the rain?
Yeah, well, the the science on altitude is not certain by any way. There are different schools of thought on altitude, but the Kenyans take it as it is, and it seems to be doing them well. So they don't complain. One guy told me, he said, we use the science of the plane ticket, because there's different theories about when you should come down from altitude. Some people say you should come down just the day before the race. Some people say you need 2 weeks before. And they say we use the science of the plane ticket. When we get the plane ticket for the race, we come down from altitude. They don't worry too much about the science of things.
Yeah, who gives them the plane ticket?
Well, I mean, these are the successful guys. I mean, you see them winning the Olympics. Once you've won the Olympics, you know, once you've won a big city marathon in Europe or America, you then get invited to races. The race organizers may send you. A lot of these guys have got agents who are organizing the races for them. They will send them there if they're not being invited by the big races. They'll send them in the hope of that they'll win and get good time. So there is a structure there, an organized structure, but it's all based purely on the possibility that once they get there, and they have such an incredible success rate, but the idea is once they get there, they win the money, that pays for everything, and then they come home.
Describe that success rate in a little bit more detail. How many races have they won in the past? Are they expected to win more races this year?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's hard to know where to start. I mean, last year in 2011, the on the official lists of marathon times, the top 25 runners were all from Kenya, and this is in the world list. So, I mean, that's complete domination of marathon times. In the World Championships, the Athletics World Championships last year, they won the track and field championships. They won in the middle and long distance events. They won 17 of the gold medals of the medals on offer, which was almost half the medals on offer. They had a clean sweep of the women's marathon, a clean sweep of the women's 10,000 meters, meaning gold, silver, and bronze. They had first and second in the men's marathon. I mean, they're getting better. This is the thing. They're as good as they've been over the years. For years and years, the Kenyans have been good. They've just been getting better and better. And this is all this snowballing effect. The more success they see, the more these kids in the countryside villages think, God, I'm not, you know, that's what I want to do. And they head for a 10 and they start training. And before you know it, you've got a whole other troop of guys turning out.
Darren Unfend, again with the Guardian newspaper, author of Running with the Kenyans. Alan Abramson, back to you. Very interesting to hear this story. Is there anything like this anywhere else in the world, or is the Kenyan situation that we've heard described unique?
It is unique. The Americans have, for instance, not won a medal in the 10,000 meters since 1964. And it is the holy grail of American distance running to try to put someone back on the medal stand. There's a promising young American runner named Galen Rupp who won the 5 and 10,000 meters in Eugene at the trials. He is probably the best prospect to have come along in many, many, many years. He's coached by Alberto Salazar. He's worth watching at these Olympics. Nobody knows whether it's his time now or he's 4 years too soon. The Kenyans are amazing. Absolutely incredible, and the rest of the world is trying to catch up.
What about the sprints? Is the U.S. able to dominate the sprints anymore?
No, the Jamaicans are dominating the sprints. Mm-hmm. It is very possible that that Usain Bolt goes one, Johan Blake goes two, and somebody else goes three, and the Americans could very well be shut out of the 100 and maybe even the 200.
Wow. What about Lolo Jones?
Well, Lolo Jones is a terrific athlete with a great marketing campaign. I will say that. Whether she medals, she could medal or she could not make the final. It's one of those deals. The hurdles is an incredibly tough race. She very well may medal. As you know, she should have medaled. She should have won in Beijing. It's so very difficult to predict in the hurdles. The woman who should win the 100-meter hurdles is somebody that most Americans have never heard of, and that's a woman from Australia named Sally Pearson. She's running 12-2 when Lolo's running 12-7. So let's see what Lolo does. We'll wait and see. Lolo does have a way of pulling stuff out when you never expect it. Most of us in the press room didn't think she was even going to make the team, and she made the team. So maybe time and luck are on Lolo's side. Who knows?
Adam Enter, back to you in Shanghai. Are there particular athletes, particular teams that the Chinese are going to be watching very closely?
Yeah, well, I mean, number one is going to be Liu Xiang, who is the hurdler, competes in the 110-meter hurdlers. He's he is by far the most popular Olympian in China, and he's also a bit of a curiosity. He came out of nowhere in 2004 in Athens to win that event. He wasn't expected to win it at all, and the Chinese have never shown any propensity to be successful in the track and field events. In 2008, you know, they had the home field advantage, and he was expected to triumph in 2008 in Beijing, but he got injured and actually pulled out of the race right as he came on the track. And that became a national soap opera. The highest levels of the Chinese government had to excuse him publicly. And so there's a lot of curiosity about how he will do in London, and there's a lot of mystery surrounding where he is. He actually left the UK the other day to go train in Germany because apparently, and this is true, he didn't like the weather. It was interfering with his training. So that's number one, Liu Xian. It's a national soap opera. The other thing they'll be watching very carefully, again, a sport that's not very popular in the U.S., is badminton. Lin Dan is a great Chinese male badminton player, and his great rival, Li Changwei of Malaysia, are expected to meet in the finals there. So that's very important. And then number three will be the basketball. Even though China will compete, they aren't expected to get very far, but the Chinese are avid NBA fans. And following Liu Xiang, I think you'd probably have to say that Kobe Bryant is the most popular athlete in China. And so they're going to be watching that with a lot of enthusiasm. I wouldn't be surprised if, when all is said and done, the USA Olympic team's basketball games are amongst the highest rated events in China during the whole 17 days of this Olympics.
Even when they're not the host country, are the Olympics very important to the Chinese?
Critically important. The Olympics for the Chinese are the Super Bowl, the World Series, the NCAA Final Four, everything wrapped up into one. They don't have meaningful professional leagues here, but it also goes back to the culture of sport that's existed in China since 1979 when they decided to re-enter the Olympic movement. There was the very determined choice made at the very highest levels of the Chinese government that Olympic sports and success at the Olympics would be a way of projecting and symbolizing national power. And that's not symbolizing it for foreigners, but very much as a way of emphasizing the success of the party and the state to the Chinese people themselves. And that's been very much bought into. And you can see that, I mean, right now, if you go to the People's Daily, which is the official newspaper of the Communist Party of China, you'll see right there on the homepage, they already have the medal tally up, you know, and it went up 2 days ago. And this is extremely important. You know, they want to win the most gold medals, and they actually emphasize training in sports where there are a lot of medals given, like weightlifting, like archery, like shooting, with the express purpose that they can run up that medal total. And that's a big thumbs up from the Chinese people. They, you know, over the course of this period, you'll see them really enthusiastic about shooting sports, of all things. And even in the months and years after, you'll see those gold medalists in shooting feted, you know, across China. They've enhanced and projected national power and symbolized the success of the Chinese state. So it's a very, very different way of looking at sport. Not nearly as much fun, in my opinion, as sort of the way we approach it maybe in the U.S. and the U.K.
An enormously important matter from a national standpoint. Darren and Finn, what about the Kenyans? Is it mainly individuals in that country that depend to such an extent on the Olympics and that train so hard for it?
Yeah. I mean, there's very little structural organization. The main athletics, Kenya, the track and field body, kind of take over a couple of weeks before the Olympics, but they have very little input the rest of the year. People in Kenya will be very excited about it. They love seeing their country up on the world stage, winning medals and you know, kind of dominating one of the centerpiece sports in the Olympics, and they get very excited about it. So they'll be all congregating in bars and cafes with big screens and getting very excited about the running.
And Alan Abramson, as far as Americans are concerned, it would seem we enjoy the Olympics when they're on, and then we move on. And as you indicated earlier, don't devote a lot of attention to it in between. What about doping this year? Has that been an issue?
No. Only morons get caught doping at the Olympic Games. People know how to avoid getting caught anymore, at least in the United States. So I would expect there will be some doping cases. If an American gets caught doping at the Games, he or she is really very, very silly anymore. the protocols are pretty well known about how to avoid getting caught here.
So back to the overall predictions. The Wall Street Journal says Americans are going to be supreme. Xinhua, as we've just heard, suggests that the Chinese will win the most gold. Alan Abramson, you've been studying this for so long. What do you think?
I think it's going to be a very good games for both the United States and for Great Britain. I really do.
And not China?
Oh, I think China will do very well, but almost inevitably after the Chinese had what was called Project 119 for the 2008 games, and it's very, very hard to sustain that kind of financial resource and that kind of momentum in the games after you have a home games. I would not be surprised if there's a letdown.
Darren and Finn with The Guardian, will Brits be disappointed if Alan Abramson turns out to be wrong and they don't do extraordinarily well?
Oh, yes. Yes, there's a lot of excitement building, and they're hoping to see a lot of success, particularly in the sports that I mentioned earlier, the sitting down sports, the cycling and the rowing and the sailing. But also on the track, there's a couple of strong hopes on the track, which everyone, you know, that always seems to be the event that captures the imagination. There's a heptathlete, Jessica Ennis, and unbelievably a long distance runner as well, Mo Farah, who trains with Galen Rupp, the American. He's a shot for a gold medal or possibly even two. So that will bring the house down, I'm sure, in the stadium.
So, Alan Abramson, quickly back to you. We heard that one of the big races of all is going to be on Saturday between Phelps and Lochte in the pool. What are the other major events to look for this coming weekend?
This coming weekend?
Yeah.
It's all swimming and gymnastics this coming weekend. It's always swimming and gymnastics the first weekend. And by the way, my colleague is absolutely right. Mo Farah is probably going to win both the 5 and the 10K on the track. He's sensational. This weekend, it's all swimming and all gymnastics, and Great Britain's going to be freaked out by cycling. which Americans will be like, oh, ho hum.
You win the Tour de France, and it becomes a big deal.
Right.
And then track and field come late. That's always scheduled that way.
Always the second week. But the men's 100-meter final is the 5th of August, which will have the world riveted. Let's see whether Usain Bolt can actually start cleanly.
And who's going to win the soccer championships, male and female?
Well, nobody in the United States is paying the least bit of attention to the men's soccer championships because the United States is not in it. And as you know, it's men under 23. The women's championships, I think the United States has a very, very good chance of winning. So that's my summary for you there.
Okay, but the men's team didn't even get there.
No, didn't even qualify.
Wow. Okay. Well, thank you all very much. We'll all be looking forward to this. Alan Abramson, Adam Minter, Adarin and Finn, and our earlier guest, Nick Harris from Britain. Good to have all of you with us, and we'll watch the games and look to hear from all of you as they go on. Thanks again for being on our program. After the massacre in Aurora, Colorado, will gun violence be an issue in this year's presidential campaign? We'll hear what the president and his Republican challenger have had to say about that in the last couple of days in a moment on To the Point.
Share your comments about today's show at kcrw.com/to the point or join the conversation on our Facebook page. You can also follow us on Twitter at @to_the_point_kcrw.
We're not only back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. In the aftermath of what happened last week in Aurora, Colorado last night, NBC's Brian Williams asked Mitt Romney if there should be a national conversation about assault weapons in the hands of civilians and whether 6,000 rounds of ammunition should be available on the Internet.
Well, this person shouldn't have had any kind of weapons and bombs and other devices, and it was illegal for him to have many of those things already, but he had them. And so we can sometimes hope that just changing a law will make all bad things go away. It won't. Changing the heart of the American people may well be what's essential to improve the lots of the American people.
James Rainey is political blogger for the LA Times election blog Politics Now. Good to have you back on our program.
Thanks, Warren.
Does that sound like Mitt Romney wants to have a major conversation about gun violence in the United States?
No, he doesn't want to talk about this at all. And he wants to talk about it slightly less than President Obama wants to talk about it. Neither one of them really wants to get into this.
Mitt Romney, when he was governor of Massachusetts, signed an assault weapons ban.
Yeah, he did, and he talked kind of tough about how he wouldn't be taking the line of the NRA. But of course, that was when he was running in a quite liberal state, and you know, he's there. Of course, a multitude of examples where he's shifted his position as he's positioned himself to run on the national stage.
But that's, of course, what every candidate does, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to say that he's invented something new here. I mean, the interesting thing on that Brian Williams answer was that he actually gave a truthful and straightforward answer to a question that wasn't asked. So if Brian Williams had asked him about all the bombs and grenades and things that were left in the suspect's apartment, his answer applied to that. But he didn't want to answer the question about guns because it's just not. He really doesn't see that as a winner with moderate voters. I think even moderate voters probably think it might be a good idea to ban, say, a 100-shot drum or to keep people that are on the terrorist watch list from owning guns. But both those things have been proposed and can't make any headway in Congress.
And, of course, Mr. Romney also said that alleged a shooter in last week's incident was already violating the law because he had some things. What did he mean by that? And does that suggest on his part that he thinks there are enough laws already?
Well, that's what I was trying to suggest when he was answering. In other words, saying the things he had were illegal. Yes, that's true. The grenades were illegal. The explosives were illegal. But by speaking about those things, which were back in the apartment, he avoided talking about the heavy weaponry that the suspect had on him. And I think, yes, he's absolutely saying that he thinks current laws are adequate. But again, I think most Americans, in fact, polling shows that most Americans do think, as I suggested, if you're on the terrorist watch list, we probably don't want you to have a gun. If you have a massive magazine of bullets, of ammunition, people don't really like that idea either, the polling shows. But even proposals to cut back on those sorts of things have not made any headway with the Congress.
Okay, we've heard from Mitt Romney responding to a question. Here is President Obama yesterday in New Orleans. He addressed the issue this way.
I, like most Americans, believe that the Second Amendment guarantees an individual the right to bear arms. I think we recognize the traditions of gun ownership that passed on from generation to generation, that hunting and shooting are part of a cherished national heritage. But I also believe that a lot of gun owners would agree that AK-47s belong in the hands of soldiers, not in the hands of criminals.
James Ranney, back to you with the LA Times election blog Politics Now. Does that suggest that the president wants to discuss this issue at great length with Mitt Romney?
No, he doesn't. It suggests that he wants to signal to his supporters, yes, I hear you, it's insane to have heavy weaponry out on the streets, but don't hold your breath on me pushing for anything. I mean, particularly before the election, it might be sort of a wink and a nod that once I get reelected, if I manage to get reelected, I'll push harder for these kinds of things. But everyone right now is worried about that 10% of voters they're almost mythical, the ones in the middle who don't pay much attention until maybe October. And the thought is that a high percentage of those people might have different feelings and not be as pro-gun control. But nobody knows for sure their feelings, so they like to hedge their bets on that question.
And whatever you say might well end up in a commercial at some point in the campaign, whether it's out of context or otherwise. What did the president have to say when he was running for office in 2008 on this issue?
Well, he spoke very clearly, and he had in the past also, that he wanted to bring back the national ban on assault weapons, which had lapsed in 2004. There's sort of a consensus, not sort of, there is a consensus on the Democratic side that it would be good to renew the assault weapons ban, which we do have in some states, like in California, but renew it nationally. But again, there's a difference between saying you're for something and taking your full weight of your office as president and really spending some time pushing hard, especially given this most recent incident, to get something passed. And it doesn't appear so far that the president is willing to do that.
So polls show that people might like to see some kind of gun control, but less than they used to.
Yeah, and again, this could be a chicken and egg thing. Absolutely, the poll showed there's not as much interest in gun control. Maybe the Supreme Court ruling, you know, sort of affirming the strength of the Second Amendment, maybe that has had some impact. Those who were for gun control, though, might suggest if a few leaders like President Obama got out in front of this and really made the case, that those polls would turn right around and we would see, you know, more support for additional gun control laws. I think it's hard to say because the conversation is so muted on both sides right now. We don't really know what would happen.
Okay, we'll leave it at that. James Rainey, political blogger for the LA Times election blog Politics Now. Thanks as always.
Thanks, Warren.
Today's program produced by Christian Bordahl with Daniel Rothberg and Lada Pandya. Our technical director is Mike Newport. I'm Warman Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast. It's a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.